Good afternoon, Myrna. I see there's still people joining. Supervisor Parlin is with us, so that's good. And I see a lot of the other previous participants, but is there anybody in particular you think we need to wait for?
I do not believe so. And I've made you guys co-host, so you should be able to take control of this whole meeting. I think everybody that's needs to be here is here, and I'll just keep letting people in.
Okay,
very good. Thank you. Hey, Myrna, before we start, I think you might have accidentally made someone called anonymous co-host.
Myrna.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's someone who called in, but you probably don't want to be a Ms. Co-host, so might want to remove that.
So Supervisor Parlin, Lori, are you ready to get started? There you are.
Always ready. Let's go.
Okay. All right. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and call this meeting to order. This is the, I think it's the third ad hoc public meeting we've had on the subject of hemp. And so we do have an agenda for today's meeting. It's scheduled to run from like 2 to 4:30. I'm hoping everybody who's in participation here had a chance to review the agenda. Before we get to that, though, I would like to ask if there's anyone with us today who has not participated in any of the previous meetings so that we get recognition of newcomers, new people getting involved, if there's anyone in that category. So do we have anyone present with us today? This is the first time they've participated in one of these ad hoc committee meetings. And Myrna, you have to help me, I guess, if we can see hands raised or something or other. I don't see any.
I'm not seeing any hands raised either. So
we do
got to set my...
Right. We do have some call-ins.
I know that one of my call-ins is our Ag Commissioner, Bill Draper. He called in because he's on the road. So he is one of the people, and he has been present before.
Okay.
And he's that 8521 number.
Got it. All right. And I recognize, almost all the names here before. So I'm guessing we probably don't have any new participants. So that's good. It doesn't hurt if we have new participants, but at least everybody kind of knows one another, hopefully by now, and can share information openly. So with that, and moving to the agenda, I know there was some discussion of perhaps letting Lieutenant Mike Cook go first as opposed to item one, which is updates state and federal. I don't know if we have a preference for that. Lieutenant Cook, would you prefer to go first before we do those updates, or what's your thoughts?
It's okay with me, whatever you like to do.
Okay, then I'll look to Daniel and Charlene. What do you think is the better lead in as the agenda is proposed, or have Lieutenant Cook lead in and then follow up with what's number one right now?
I believe Charlene only had a brief comment, so I don't think it'll take long. So it might just make sense. Oh, sorry, Charlene, I didn't mean to talk over you there.
Okay.
That's okay. No, this okay. Is really brief.
Okay, so let's do number one. So we're really just the updates for state and federal. I didn't realize, recognize how much material might be there, but it sounds like it's going to be relatively short. So please, Charlene.
Yeah, really all it is the CDFA, which is the California Department of Food and Agriculture, is reviewing the federal final rule and seeing what they will need to do as far as updating the regulations. Their legal is looking at it to see whether there needs to be any legislative changes, but most of it will probably be regulation. And that's all I have for right now.
Okay, thank you for that. Daniel, I'm assuming you don't have anything for the front end here?
No, I did want to make one comment, just that we've been getting a fair amount of comments from people related to the commercial cannabis program. Just to be clear, in order to keep make sure we don't have a violation of the Brown Act here, we're here to discuss the industrial hemp program. We can't discuss the commercial cannabis program because that would be a Brown Act issue. So,
right. So we'll have to defer those discussions to another place and time. But yes, yeah. Thank you for that advisory. So with that, Lieutenant Cook, would you please share with us the information you provided? And hopefully everybody got the package that Myrna had emailed out, which includes Lieutenant Cook's presentation, as well as the draft that Daniel's put together. So everybody hopefully has that package of information. If you don't, I would recommend that you either enter it in the chat box that you need to receive it, or text, I guess text Myrna or somebody to try to get it, because we can try to do that, I guess, while the meeting's progress. Maybe best thing to do is email Myrna if you don't have it, and or you don't want to enter it in the chat box at this point. So with that, Lieutenant Cook, please, yeah, take us through your presentation.
So real quick, I want to ask Myrna, on the PowerPoints that I sent, our center two, I didn't see the bigger one. Did that one get attached to the agenda, Myrna? The link.
I did not post the 104 page one, and we are going to post it out on the HIMP ad hoc screen or webpage. It would have bombed this whole meeting. It was rather large. The other one, do you have it? Do you need me to post it now, or do you have
I'm going
to
give it a whirl.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So yeah, I've got a rather larger one, over 100 page one that I really put together for public view and more directed for the board members to review. It just gives them a broader perspective. I promise you, I chopped it down to 30 something. I should be able to do it in about 10 minutes. It should give you a good general flavor of the unintended consequences that come with cultivation of cannabis. This is not in any way, shape, or form directed to the cultivators. They don't ask for this or want these things to happen, but it happens. So with that, I'm just going to review really quickly to some of the stuff that's not just regionally or California. I'll go over some stuff throughout the states, but my bigger package even covers international criminal activity from Canada, Spain, Australia, et cetera. So it's a much broader view, but what you'll find no matter what, whether it is local or the states or international, you're gonna find that there's a common kind of scheme here going on. It's common type of crimes that are occurring no matter where it's at. So let me just go on here. All right, do you have that?
We do, but it's not in a presentation format. It's the front sheet, and then it also shows next slide. So I don't know if you can go to presentation. So yeah, that's better. Thank you.
I'm a little slow at this.
No, that's fine. You're there.
Okay, so I'm just going to basically, I'm not going to read you the entire stories. I'm going to give you a lowdown. A lot of times, just the headline story itself will kind of give you an idea of what happened, and I'll just touch on a few things as we move along quickly, okay? So we'll start with an article out of Fresno County. Hemp farms are on the rise in Fresno County, and crooks are mistaking plants for marijuana. I'll talk about that a little bit more after the end of this. The new trend in Fresno County has farmers using land to grow legal industrial hemp. However, would-be thieves are targeting these plants thinking it's marijuana. Three such cases have been reported in the last 2 weeks. One of the suspects pointed a gun at the victim. A little bit more here. $1 billion worth of cannabis seized in California hemp field bust. It was a sprawling 459 acre. I think I talked about this a couple meetings ago. There was 10 million marijuana plants that were under the guise of a hemp field. And I've also talked about commingling before. So this kind of stresses that a little bit more. Kings County officials arrested three men of theft of 33 industrial plants, which led to a high-speed chase in excess of 100 miles an hour. Riverside County, four arrested in alleged robbery at Winchester Hemp Farm. Three men and women were arrested for allegedly stealing plants for a lawful hemp farm in Winchester at gunpoint. 2 acres of plants vandalized in Templeton Farm. Someone drove an ATV through about half the crop or destroyed about 60% of the crop. Santa Maria man accused of stealing hemp worth $350. Hemp growers want Solano to kind of temper things down. I believe that they were not under any type of ordinance at the time. And then because of some crimes associated to that, they went into a moratorium. And during that time, the board said discussion was a reaction to the reports of criminal activity around some of the 9 farming sites, including reports of gunfire, burglary, and dangerous high-speed chases. Boardman said it's a health and safety issue. I don't want to see someone get killed. More on that. The sheriff's office reported more than 50 calls of service since September. This was a November article, so it was about a month. Sheriff told the supervisor his biggest fears is that one of his deputies would be ambushed while responding to a call. And he actually mentioned Brian Ishmael. Alleged thieves caught with car full of stolen hemp in Solano. Alleged hemp theft in Peru leads to arrest of 70-year-old man. I won't read his story, but his accomplice, maybe he was younger and got away, but one of the guards or workers there at the hemp farm was able to catch the 70-year-old man. So again, I'm going to touch on some other states. You're going to see it's a lot of the same stuff. This is a general article for kind of a national type of report, hemp theft skyrocket in the U.S. They talk about Fresno County, Texas, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, New York. And the headliner at the bottom is, aside from the thefts themselves being upsetting and costly, the involvement of firearms and violence is becoming more commonplace. Alabama, 4 arrested for hemp theft. Colorado, likely mistake thieves steal 300,000 worth of cannabis look-alike in Colorado. Indiana, hemp farm becomes a target for thieves following legalized hemp as a crop. Priest reports show thieves hit the same farm 3 times the last 2.5 weeks. The crime comes after thieves stole over 1,000 hemp plants from the same farm earlier that month. Michigan, 6 arrested after theft of Michigan hemp farm, farmer hit by suspect's car. As the farmers approached the vehicle, attempted to make contact with the occupants, the driver of the vehicle tried to flee the scene and ran over the farmer. Oregon, arrest made in separate suspected hemp thefts. Pennsylvania, report that someone stole hemp plants valued at $80,000 from hemp farm. Tennessee, armed robbery, a new term for the hemp industry is armed robbery. little did Tracy know that the chance to encounter thieves would end up in automatic weapons gunfire in the Aryan Brotherhood. Utah, 3 men arrested in connection to $40,000 worth of hemp product theft. This is a reward out of Virginia, hefty reward offered by hemp. Burglars had made off with enough hemp over the past week to result in 6-figure losses. I'm not going to read this story because I actually have a video of this story, a YouTube video at the end, so I'll just let you watch the YouTube video. Washington, hemp farmer loses 70 grand in plants. The thieves think it's marijuana. We start off with a few plants here and they were getting pulled. And it gradually just ramped up kind of out of control to where last night, Sunday, we had people that were armed getting out of vehicles to come steal the plants. Wisconsin, 2 suspects arrested for stealing hemp plants in Columbia County. They recovered approximately 10 pounds of stolen hemp flower with an approximate value of $1,000. Excuse me. Here's my video, but let's see if it plays.
I had a bit of a bigger caliber that went through and killed my son. And 3 inches high, it hit him in the back of the head. I ain't never got shot at over a crop before this.
Kenny Powell has farmed his entire life. Never once did he think he or his family could be in danger. Until now.
They shot at my flesh and blood now. You know, it's a different story.
Powell is one of several farmers who have planted 200 acres
CBD hemp
here in Greensville County. Recently, though, there's been trouble.
Y'all caught one guy on the dually, blue dually. He stole a bunch of plants in the daytime.
But Thursday night, an encounter almost turned deadly for his son.
He pulled up on something the other night, and he told him to hold it. The cop was coming, and they opened fire on my son's truck and shot 3 bullets at it.
Kenny Powell has slept in his field and posted guards in the fields, all in an attempt to keep thieves out, because this crop,
it is a big, big, big investment,
is more than just about making a dollar.
This hemp market is going to get me back on my feet to keep from losing everything I've worked for all my whole life and what my daddy left me.
Now one son works the night shift guarding the crops and the entire family doing something else new.
Now look what I'm going to do. To protect my crop.
It's something this farmer never thought he'd do.
I'm 52 years old, but I don't want to get killed either. And I don't want to have to hurt nobody.
Okay. So I have you back.
Okay.
So go ahead. Now, the reason I showed you that very brief kind of summary, I think you get an idea of what's going on, and you'll find that even in the 100 pages that I provided you, I could probably give you a couple hundred more off YouTube, but I think I would kill that subject. But the idea is you're going to find the same thing that's happening across our nation and, you know, across the world, quite frankly. And generally, their thefts are thefts that have gone bad. And some of those thefts have gone bad. There's a lot of gunfire exchange, assaults, and the like. So we've been talking a lot about pushing this ordinance through, but, you know, some of the things I'm going to present to you this week like this and some other things the next 2 weeks, is this really the best thing for our community? Do we want to draw more criminal activity? Will this happen? I believe based on our training experience that yes, it probably will. And I don't even really have to guess that it might happen because it did happen. We had one reported theft from a licensed hemp grow last year. So it's already started. It's here. It's already begun. Fortunately, nothing bad happened other than theft, but these are the type of things that we will start seeing. And there will be some arguments. Well, as I talked about earlier, they're mistakenly stealing hemp because they think it's marijuana. But you have to put yourself in a criminal opportunist mind. If I stole hemp and found out that it was hemp later, I'm not going to throw it in the garbage can. It looks like marijuana, smells like marijuana. I'm going to jump on Instagram or Facebook, and I'd probably sell a couple hundred pounds in 2 days to who knows who, and they're going to think it's marijuana. I'll get black marijuana prices for it all day long. I'll take no risk. They won't know who I am. I know this because I've done it. I worked undercover narcotics. The sheriff has. He probably did the same thing. Now, I didn't sell hemp as marijuana, but they don't stop to really examine the product most of the times. These exchanges take seconds. So if I had stole a bunch of hemp, I can promise you I'm going to go out there and steal for a black market marijuana price, and I will sell every bit of it at no risk. So whether it's mistaken or not, they're not really losing out. So as they start discovering these things, even if they discover later that, oh, darn it, it's not the marijuana I wanted, they're still going to end up scoring, and they're going to come back and do more thieving. So is this what we want to face? Do we want to create more of this? Do we want to create more criminal opportunities for these folks? Not our growers. I'm not blaming our growers. None of our growers want to be victims. None of our growers want to be assaulted or shot at. But this is an unintended consequence, if you would, a negative side effect that just comes with cannabis. That's really all I have for you, and I will email you the big fat one and ask you to look at this. Even if you can't read it all, I get it. Just look at the headlines and look at where it's from, and I think you're going to get a good idea that this is for real and it happens everywhere and it's not going away. That's all I have.
Thank you, Lieutenant. So with that, Lori, I don't have any questions at this point for Lieutenant. Do you have anything you'd like to ask him? Okay. Then let's open it up for any of the participants, any of the panelists, questions or comments on Lieutenant Cook's presentation. Raise your hand, please. So Lee, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Lieutenant Cook, do you have any statistics? So I realize that you collected a bunch of hemp crimes from 2019 to present. I counted roughly 20, maybe there's more, maybe there's less, but roughly. In your 100-page report or in your research, do you know how many total crimes have been committed at hemp farms? And the reason I'm asking is because there are some 26,000 licensed legal hemp growers in the United States, just in the United States. And if we're seeing that there's 100 or 300 or 500 in total, statistically, that's a relatively small amount of crime. Now, I agree with you. We don't want to bring crime into El Dorado County, but I do want to put things in perspective that, you know, if we're looking at a very small percentage across the country in hemp crime, and if I look at what happened in El Dorado County last year, it was, you know, of the 10 growers, one got hit, 10%. I guess it's not a big, huge crime wave as it's being portrayed. And I just want to bring some perspective to that conversation.
Well, I guess you'd have to determine what percentage it seems to be okay to you. I would say one or two is too many, especially if it gets bad, people are shooting at one another, or your family gets assaulted, or your workers get assaulted, or people are pointing guns at you and there's gun exchange fire. It only happens once, that's once too many. So the answer to your question, do I know how many in the world? No, there's no way for me to know. And I'll tell you part of the reason is I'm sure you're fully aware that a mass majority of the press releases today are put out by law enforcement or on Facebook and Twitter. And you cannot retrieve that information on a keyword search. I'd be doing this for the rest of my life. There's a lot of them out there. There's a lot more on YouTube. I just simply pulled up stuff that I found, news articles that were written. So I didn't do a deep dive look because I know there's more out there. But I with no way I could be able to tell you how many total throughout the world. Seems to be an awful lot for an industry that just started.
Okay, Ruben, I think you were next, and then Rod.
Thank you. And thank you, Lieutenant Cook, for this information. You brought up some valid points. As a former crime analyst, I like to look at the details and stuff. And I guess for me, I'm always looking at trends. And as you, again, this isn't all the information that you have, but the briefer version of what was sent out, it looks like all of those articles were from 2019. So it looks, just from a trending situation, it looks like that occurred in a time where we were transitioning when the Farm Bill became legal to grow hemp. So then there was a lot of confusion and misinformation out there. So at least from what you have shown there, nothing has occurred, at least from that part, after 2019. I'm sure the stuff has happened, but it seems to be as people get more information and understand it, that it's a different product, there seems to be less incentive for them to put themselves in a situation where they're going to steal something that isn't worth as much. And then on the other states, so California, all of those were 2019. And then from the other states, 8 was in 2019, 3 from 2020, and 2 from 2021. So again, just bringing it up that the longer this is out there, the more information is out there. I believe the trend shows that there'll be less crime associated with it. Thank you.
So you were looking at my summary, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, I have 103 pages. I'm sure you might change your mind on that. But again, I'll repeat myself. Last season, we had a theft here. And we just started. And don't think for even a second that the criminal opportunists are not going to take every opportunity to steal and to make money off this. They don't differentiate whether it's marijuana or hemp. They really don't care. You're going to be able to make the same amount of money off of it no matter what. Even if it's mistaken, they're still going to go sell it as weed.
Understood. But I guess if we were going to single out hemp, we should also look at, again, I don't have access to the raw data anymore, but we could say, okay, what happens in the vineyards? What happens in other issues? So I understand your...
Well, we're all here to talk about him. Correct?
Thank you, sir.
Okay, let's go to Rod.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Obviously, it reflects a lot of work. But, I mean, if we outlawed things that were valuable in our county, you know, some of our best industries wouldn't be here. We have jewelry stores, banks. I mean, there are valuable things. One of the big advantages of legalization is now for the first time, we're able to partner with law enforcement. And that's what makes our community safer rather than forcing people to go underground where that's where the criminals really in the past have worked without retribution. So, I mean, particularly as these products, eventually the prices are going to go down, you know, as the, you know, the market forces work, eventually we'll have a real market. And that's what's going to really get criminals out of the way, as there won't be the profit for them. You know, there's, I think there's 6,000 you know, commercial cannabis cultivation sites throughout the state. So I mean, I don't know how many hemp are throughout the state, but it's here. I just think hiding from it is not going to work. I mean, some of the wineries, they have very valuable products. I mean, there's $200 bottles of wine. You know, I think we do the things to protect our operations and work with law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, Rod. Any other comments or questions for Lieutenant Cook? Dale, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you for your presentation, Lieutenant Cook. It looked to me like every one of those thefts, if you will, the criminal activity involved cannabis plants, which, to borrow a term, phenotype, that phenotypically look like flower and seed producers. Did you run across any theft from hemp farms that were growing for fiber or pulp or things like that that you were aware of?
No, a lot of the articles were not very specific. Sometimes they just said hemp. Sometimes they said cannabis. I even read articles where the writers were clearly not educated in the subject and would call it marijuana, and then it was hemp, then it was marijuana, and then it was hemp. But did I look for fiber versus CBD? I did not. I looked for hemp crimes. Okay. Hemp is hemp is hemp.
Well,
you know, to the criminal opportunist, hemp is hemp is hemp, and it could be marijuana to them.
And my point is that what is marketable right now, either is biomass or a CBD flower, phenotypically look like a marijuana plant, if you will. And I guess that's one of the problems with this having market value, because it looks and smells like a marijuana flower. Part of my concern is I don't want anybody getting hurt growing something that you can't get high from, thinking that it's going to make you high. And that's the black market influence we still have to deal with over the cannabis and the hemp flower and CBD production. So I just was curious if anybody's getting their 20-foot tall fiber plants taken at gunpoint, or if it's only the ones that look like a marijuana plant.
You know, the journalists don't generally get into that. I'll be honest with you, sometimes the pictures they associate to the articles might not even be from that cultivation site. That's not uncommon. They might just Google it, post a picture. Did I get that in depth? I did not. I'm going to assume that probably the more it looks like marijuana, the greater likelihood is that somebody's going to want it. Some of these criminal opportunists aren't the brightest thing in the world, and they're just going to take anything they can. It just is what it is. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other panelists who had a question or comment? I guess I have one after this discussion, Mike, and that is relative to other reports of agricultural product thefts. My family farming operation has incurred a lot of thefts. We grow Bing cherries, and it's a very popular crop for everybody who can come out at night to just go out and harvest whatever they want and drive away. And it's a very difficult crop to protect. It doesn't have the value anywhere near what marijuana would have, but yet there's still a lot of reported thefts, and we fight that every year to try to get the proper law enforcement and surveillance to the extent that we're getting out of that business. We can't afford to try to do that anymore because the theft rate has risen to the point you can't defend it. So within El Dorado County, have you had specific reports of agricultural product theft? I mean, wine is a product that's been obviously processed and it's in a commodity that can be taken quickly, but I'm talking about the raw product, whether it be wine grapes, whether it be apples, whether it be whatever, as an agricultural product. Do you typically get reports of thefts of other agricultural products over an annual period?
You know, I can't answer that question, but I can easily get that information for you probably by next meeting. If there's reported thefts to us for apples or Christmas trees or whatever, or grapes. I do know because I work major crimes, investigations, homicide. I know that they're not shooting each other at Apple Farms. Are there thefts? There may very well be. Now I can get that information if you'd like. If you want to compare apples
I was just curious as to whether you get a lot of reports, because I know the whole agricultural industry, the ag farmers and stuff have had to work real hard to figure out how they're going to stay in business with some of the things that are going on, because there are a lot of people that are out stealing anything to sell for drugs. That's the reality of where we are. I mean, they take copper, they cut out electrical lines, they destroy pumps and any number of pieces of farming equipment. So
this is true, but it's already here and well established. My point is why would we bring in another attraction?
Got it. Okay.
I mean, why add to the pile of criminal activity we already have? It's nobody's fault here. I'm not blaming the cultivators. It's the other faction of folks that want to come steal from these folks that causes concern for me and is a public safety matter. That's going to cause, staffing issues for us if these really start to increase and get out of control, like the other side of the cannabis house ended up being. You know, it's a constant problem for us. And this could easily go right down that same path.
Okay, point well taken. Any other comments or questions? I'm not seeing any at this point from anybody. So let's assume we can move to item 3 then, and that's Daniel's update for us on the draft ordinance.
Yes, thank you. I think that this was provided to everyone, but if it'd be easier, I can kind of share my screen of just the Word document here. So our last meeting, you wanted me to come back to, you requested for me to come back with some more specific language. This kind of touches on the issues that we have discussed. There were other issues and a more comprehensive approach that haven't been, that I don't have anything in here on because we haven't made a decision on them yet, such as enforcement and fees and destruction of comps, crops and testing and signage. I can kind of, if you want to do it, I can kind of walk you through that, and then we can kind of go back and forth if there are some questions. This is just sort of the general definitions. One thing that we had talked about before was this whole concept of the sensitive receptor, and I know that Supervisor Parlin had some reservations of that term because, like, what I discovered is that term actually came from federal Clean Air Act regulations, really. So I did some more research and I found San Benito County, I thought, had a clever way of doing this that was a little bit easier. They just basically used this term sensitive use, and they defined it to be certain types of facilities, and these are the facilities that are listed here, and use that instead, because it's not this sort of kind of wishy-washy general term. It's a very clear enumeration. And our cannabis ordinance does use a similar process. Mr. Tenenbaum, do you have a question right now?
Yeah, just a quick question, please. I appreciate the work you've put into this, and I understand what sensitive use means, but my question is if we have, and it doesn't apply to me, I'm just asking as a general question, if we have a hemp farm that is established and someone down the street decides they want to open a childcare facility, what are your thoughts on how to deal with that potential conflict of a sensitive use? And that was just a question.
No, that's a very good point. And I saw this addressed in a couple of the ordinances, and how they would define it is they basically define the use, and we could certainly do the same here, is they define the use as the time that you request for the permit or license. So in that license, if it's a 1-year license anyway, and if someone else did move in during that year, you, at very least, pretty good throughout that license, and maybe then we'd have to think about what happens then, but that's an approach we could take, so.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that, you know, as time goes on, we don't get moved or an inability to reestablish our license if we have met the criteria previously. Like I would hope that there would be some kind of a grandfather in clause as opposed to, somebody opened a childcare down the street, so I can't grow hemp anymore on my property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something we can certainly consider. I didn't go into great detail of the concept of renewing licenses here other than just sort of state it, but that's something we could put in more detail about. I kind of It's a good point to think about. So
yeah, it was just food for thought. Thank you.
Yep. All right. So that's the term I use there. And some of these, I said, are a cannabis ordinance, although it doesn't use the term sensitive use. This enumeration of certain types of facilities are similar to what is in our cannabis ordinance. And in fact, I kind of cross-referenced them there. So,
Daniel, I'm surprised it doesn't just mention a public facility of any kind. I mean, whether it's a park site, whether it's a library, any public facility, I would think should be one of the general headings. And yet it seems like they've gotten down into the weeds without addressing what I think is that top heading.
Yeah. And this is just the list I pulled from San Benito. But yeah, we can put whatever the board and the committee and then the later board wants to put here, whatever we'd like to put as the types of uses that we don't want near. But it'd be completely within the discretion of the board. So.
All right. Okay. Yep. Thanks.
Yep. Sure. One kind of just note on terminology. I kind of went back and forth whether we wanted to call this a license or permit. Generally, I would more defer to license, more to permit, because that usually indicates something that is more ministerial in nature, but we already have a cannabis permit. I thought that'd be more confusing. So I just went with license. There's no real legal reason to use one or the other, but just a note on terminology here. I get a little bit here on just what the license requirement would theoretically look like. And this is kind of touching on the conversation we had last time on whether we wanted CEQA to apply to this license. And for the default is it would not, because the way that I wrote this is it's ministerial in nature, and then it's like the, supervisor of parliament, it's, you're checking the boxes that someone has met certain requirements and you're not making discretionary choices, except for, and we'll touch on that in a minute, for if someone wants a different setback, they can request a conditional use permit, but that's would be up to the applicant to make that choice. He's kind of putting in here that, you need the state registration. These are kind of just common things I found in a lot of the county, other counties, things that seemed consistent with our previous discussions. Like a lot of counties have language to this effect saying that, you have to prove that you either own the land or you get permission from the owner of the land, which seems reasonable. And this is the, I think these are consistent with the type of zones we talked about before. The one thing that I know Charlene and I discussed a little bit, because I think we were a little bit on, I think the committee was not quite firm on the question of forest land. It probably seems unlikely that anyone would grow up there. I don't know if that's necessarily a problem to grow up there or not. You could make a choice on how you want to handle that. Put it here. Just if people needed pesticides, this would just be existing, they'd have to require that. In this sort of the more ministerial nature of the permit would be, or the license, sorry, is kind of found here, is that it's saying that for the most part, an agricultural commissioner is going to grant the license if you meet the requirements. And kind of here are the general reasons that the person would potentially say no, was that, inaccurate or incomplete, didn't pay your right fees, and you don't meet state requirements. I've got a placeholder here is that we had discussed, and I think this is probably something that we'd want to kind of loop back together when we discuss an enforcement scheme, is to say that if you had sort of an enforcement action, whether that bans you from future years. I discussed with my colleague Roger, who works in code enforcement, and he'd say that if we wanted to refer to somebody who has not just been cited, but had, failed to do any of those steps, and then you had a third party verify the citation. It's called Desert Sustained, means is that either a hearing officer or a court would have sustained the actual citation. But, we can kind of put the pin on that for now, and because that might be something we want to discuss in enforcement, just wanted to put it as a placeholder. And I put in here that if the application is denied, we would probably just give a reason why the denial, and the person could resubmit and potentially cure it, depends on the nature of denial. This is kind of touches on the conversation we had last time, Supervisor Heidel, of if someone wanted to do a different setback than what we have set below, they can request a conditional use permit, which would be much more expensive, but they could certainly do so. And this is kind of just taken from our existing cannabis thing. We could put in more detail or how that would work later. kind of the meat of the actual requirements would be here on, you know, how the requirements that apply to the cultivation. This is what we already talked about a little bit. This is common in a lot of county ordinances where they say something just says the licensee shall design the parcel in a manner that minimizes odors. We could put in more requirements. We can put less if you'd like, but that's kind of a little bit of a placeholder. I think we had kind of reached a little bit of consensus before that male plants shouldn't be planted outdoors. So I put in this that would ban cultivation outdoors of male plants. This is just a thing that, to the extent there are structures used for, say, processing of materials, that may or may not require other permits, but we would just kind of deal with that as it goes on. As far as the setbacks itself, I sort of set up a structure here, but I don't know if we really reached a decision on particular amounts, and I didn't want to presume, so kind of wanted to put that there. So, and I set up a structure that has both an outdoor setback and an indoor setback that is different. And that's kind of a discretion of what you think would be the most appropriate for our needs. And there's some comments explaining that. So, and a little bit of a placeholder here on potential signage requirements, which is required by the Food and Ag Code. And some counties do put more detail on, and a little bit of information here on an inspection scheme that I think is consistent with our prior conversation on it'd be sort of regular random inspections with some degree of advance notice. So I think that I wanted to see if there's questions or concerns from either Supervisor Heidel and Supervisor Parland, and we can discuss those. So.
Okay, so let's start. Lori, do you have any comments or questions at this point?
I'll be quite honest with you. I did not get to read this before the meeting. We had full meetings, got it late last night, I think, and I had meetings already scheduled this morning, so didn't have a chance to look. I apologize.
It's okay.
So Daniel, my thought is for, and we covered a wide spectrum of things, but coming from the side of wanting to be less restrictive as opposed to overly restrictive, I'm wondering if we could put together some kind of a statement that would deal with Lee's situation, where he is really isolated from any other real impacted areas, wherein it could state basically where a parcel of land that is isolated and or surrounded by public lands, being BLM or whatever, would have no setback requirements imposed. To start with that kind of a provision and then look at for other areas, what would the setback requirements be? That's just kind of my thought for areas that, why should you be subjected to a setback when you're isolated all by yourself, basically, and no competing factors. Now, is that going to stay that way forever? No, but it might be a way to avoid some additional processing and stuff where it isn't necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's somewhere within discretion of board about how we want to set out the setback. I think from the perspective of drafting it, what I want to avoid is trying to get into these discretionary decisions, because as we talked about that, we wanted to avoid CEQA. So as far as how we drafted the setbacks, we could also, one approach I did here was outdoor versus indoor. You could segmentate that in the sense of, like, if you are in a zone that is so isolated, like, I don't know what zone that would be, where if you are a zone that is sort of far away from everything, that your setback is very small, or however we want to do that, but we could probably discuss ways of doing that. So.
Okay. So those are my thoughts, but I do want to open it up to obviously other panelists, comments or questions on the start. This is a good start. Obviously, it's got a lot of fleshing out to do. You've left a lot of to be completed blanks should we choose to move forward with that language, but I think we're still in the discussion period in terms of what are the elements we think this needs to include, and then we'll start doing the converging and whittling things down. So with that, let's go ahead and ask for any participants who might want to comment. I see Rod's got his hand up, so let's start with you, Rod.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. It does look like a good framework to start with. Mm-hmm. I'm obviously, if anybody has heard me over the years, you know I'm not in favor of the sensitive uses that are the result of kind of imaginary hazards. I mean, if there's a real hazard with something, radioactive waste, for example, then sure, keep people away from it. But where it's some kind of imagined hazard, I mean, having school bus stops prevent somebody from having a hemp farm, I just think that's not fair public policy. It's kind of anti-free market. But clearly, the meat of this is the setbacks. And if you accommodate folks that live in the middle of nowhere, where you have 20-foot setbacks, then it's a workable policy. But if it's something where in essence, everybody has to get a CUP, then that's not going to be so good for our community. Mm. Thank you very much.
No, of course. Right. I think the sensitive uses listed were kind of what I take it from other counties. But we can certainly discuss what goes there. So that's not a firm decision. So.
Okay, Lee, I think you're next.
Thank you. A couple comments. One, and this sort of tagging along with what Rod had said, I am, and I think everybody that has grown hemp is very much against putting CUP and CEQA provisions in to try to get licensed. I understand that is in there, but I would just like to put in my vote for what it is worth, that will, in my opinion, effectively kill the hemp market in this county. And so, and then secondly, and again, tag teaming out what Rod said, and I realize that I am in a special, unique position in the county, but maybe, Daniel, we could do something with the language that says if the neighbor, the closest neighboring home is X number of feet away. Like for me, I have 2,800 feet to the closest home, and maybe if we included that, then the setbacks could be non-existent, which in my case would work. But anyway, just something to think about. I'm not opinionated on this, other than I want to, like Rod, be respectful of my neighbors, but have as little setback requirements as possible. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, Ruben, I think you're next.
I guess, Daniel, thank you for putting this together. I mean, it's a good format. I guess piggybacking on what Lee and Rod already mentioned, again, I'm just throwing out my parcel as an example, which a couple of you guys have already been there. I'm surrounded, I've got ag lands surrounding me. So if we have a unilateral X number of distance for the boundaries or the setbacks, it doesn't really, I mean, it would apply if it's on paper, but it doesn't really apply because there's nothing else going on around me. So I'm just hoping that we factor that in somehow. Otherwise, I got to do a CUP and all the expense for doing it when there's really no reason to have a setback. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben. Okay, any other comments or questions?
John, one question for Daniel. Yes, Daniel, it appears the CUP provision would only apply if the growers wants a variance to the setback. Is that correct?
Yes. Otherwise, there would be no CUP. So,
unless we add minimum lot size or something else, and then that would grow off of that. But we're really focusing on setbacks. I think we all agree that was the most sensitive area for most of the adjacent properties that would be affected. So
I'm just curious, if I know some of the counties have a waiver, so if the neighbors don't have any problem with it, that they can do like a notarized signature thing to say that they are okay with no setbacks or minimal setbacks, that could still be something we can consider.
Yes, no, that's a good idea. I think the question always comes up on the how long is that valid if the property changes ownership and, you know, the mid course of a growing season, does that, yeah, I don't know that you can have that waiver transfer with property ownership as part of, you know, the title to the property if it changes ownership. So that would be the only caveat I have, is not knowing how much you can control that at some point once the grow starts. Is it?
Well, and I know a lot of the other counties, it's something that has to be renewed on the annual basis when they come in for their licensing.
Okay, yeah. That's certainly been one way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I saw that language, and that's a good, that is a kind of how we would control. I mean, to the extent that someone did sell mid-year, you know, the hemp licensee would still be valid till the end of the license period. They would need to go get another permission to whoever the newest property owner is. So.
So with that, then what if I'm just, you know, what if someone were to sign a waiver for the neighbor thinking that things were going to be fine? They find out, you know, as the season progresses, it's not such a great neighbor and they change their mind. They need to know when they sign it, they're stuck for a whole season, right? I mean, people, I think that would be fair if we're going to allow the waiver and it has to be renewed annually, let those folks know, because I know of a situation where someone thought a neighbor was going to be great and they are not. So things change. You don't know what you don't know, quite mm-hmm. honestly. So people need to know that when they do sign a waiver.
Yeah, and I think one way we could address that is if the waiver was something that came from a county form. The county form very clearly listed that there, so that we, you know, one, it's easier for us when reviewing waivers, because we would know that it's how it's supposed to look, but we could put in stuff there to make it clear about what it is that, you know, how long the waiver lasts. So if it, yeah. We were to do that, right? So.
Okay. Edward. Ed Falkenstein, go ahead.
Hey, real quick, just a question for the group. Why aren't we following for the setbacks and things? Why aren't we following the commercial ordinance? Why are we changing it for hemp when those have already gone through the process, I guess? If we have the same concerns, maybe we should have the same restrictions and ideas on it. And then secondly, why wouldn't we follow CEQA or have them get a CEQA permit?
So Charlene or Daniel, do you want to take a cut at answering that?
Yeah, I would say that ultimately these are decisions that my role here is to provide the right amount of information for the committee members and the board to make those decisions. What I was asked to do was give kind of a framework for the setbacks. I did put in my comments that we do have existing waivers. Existing setbacks for commercial cannabis and the amount of that setback. The board could certainly adopt the same process here. And right now under our cannabis process, CEQA does apply. In our prior meeting, back in about 3 weeks ago, one of the things we discussed is, well, do we want the CEQA to apply to the hemp licenses? And the where Supervisor Heidel and when we had that discussion back and forth, Supervisor Heidel and Parlin were kind of leaning towards that they probably shouldn't apply that. It just for various reasons. I mean, the that's sort of policy reasons that beyond the scope of my department. But you know, there are strengths and benefits for going one way or the other. You know, CEQA does have this individualized determination. It does have the ability where, you know, you could look at each parcel and make the kind of call for that parcel. But it is more expensive. Right now, also we probably need to get planning involved if there was going to be CEQA involved, because they would need to review that. But those are kind of policy decisions that I would defer to the committee members and the board.
I just feel like with this, you're creating the haves and have nots between the two different types of growers. Mm-hmm. Probably treat everybody, in my opinion, mm-hmm. treat them the same.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's totally a valid position. I'm just trying to, you know, provide the right information to the board, the committee, to be able to make how they call what they want to make from this point forward. So,
yeah. Okay.
So Ed, I'll add to it just from my perspective. One of the, and I'm no expert, certainly I don't know, but one of the things that has been discussed is obviously the odor is what is most offensive, I think, to a lot of adjacent property owners. It drifts over to the property lines, the boundaries, and that's, you know, driven by a number of different weather conditions as well as topographical conditions, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, what my understanding is the odor from the CBD oil bearing hemp is not as strong as the traditional marijuana. So whether or not that's ever been measured or quantified, I don't know. There's definitely an odor with the hemp, but it's the things I've been led to believe is it's not as strong, it's not as offensive, whatever. But maybe that's a falsehood. So if that is not the case, then maybe realistically we should be looking at the same kind of setbacks. But I think the initial approach was to treat this as a new agricultural product in the county and try to address it similar to other ag products that might have odors associated with them. And most of those are pleasant odors, not unpleasant odors. So you don't end up with an apples and apples type comparison. But that's in my recollection, that's kind of why we started looking at this set of parameters we're looking at today.
Okay. And I just don't want to create an environment where we have two sets of growers that are growing essentially the same thing and they're required to do different things depending on what they call it. Just treat everybody the same, in my opinion. So that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. So other commenters here at this point, Rod, I guess your hand's up again.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we're not convinced that the 800-foot setbacks that we have in the commercial cannabis program are going to work. Nobody has a license yet. Nobody's gotten one. So I wouldn't rely on that. And, I mean, hemp is not as valuable as commercial cannabis. It's much better to just, if you're going to ban it, just go ahead and ban it rather than, you know, creating poison pill policies. That's my opinion. I think there are technical experts, as I've mentioned before, the gentleman that's doing the engineering on the odors, you know, you could invite him in. I asked him if he would be willing to come to this group, and he would be, you know, he's done measuring at both hemp farms and commercial cannabis farms. So Supervisor Hydro, he could probably answer that question for you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rod. Yep, so I'm not seeing any more hands up or comments at this point. So, okay, so again, I just want to thank you, Daniel, for your efforts. Obviously, there's more to be done here, but we really, as part of the next discussion, what happens after this is, I guess, start deciding if we are going to populate the setbacks with numbers and then add some of the additional language that we talked about today. Consistent with waivers and consistent with the type of area that the property's in, whatever, that might avoid unnecessary setback considerations where they're clearly not warranted. You know, the distance from the residence might be one way to do that. I'm not sure it's only a residence that gets affected, though, if somebody's got an area that they're doing something with, an outdoor garden or something that's different than a residence. But, you know, how frequently would that be visited or utilized, vegetable garden, whatever. Generally, they're pretty close to the residence. They're not way distant from a residence, so.
Anyway. Yeah, and one thing I forgot to note, but I put in one of the comment here, but just in general, there's a general ag setback about 50 feet, I believe. It varies slightly, but there's an existing setback for ag brands that already kind of exist. But as far as how we set them, you know, I wanted to provide you as many options as you could here, because this is probably the most restrictive type of setback where it applies to all boundary lines. This is the one that would be more about the sensitive use. And this kind of touches more on Lee's comment on you could have a setback that is connected to residential structure. I could have a combination of that. There's lots of approaches to there. And I could certainly explore putting in something on if the neighbor consents to a less setback, which then you could do that, then that'd be fine, so.
Okay, and I guess at this point, I would like to draw on our two ag commissioners who are participating. So David and Bill, do you, either one of you or both of you care to weigh in on setbacks relative to this particular to hemp as opposed to other ag products or in comparison to cannabis? Do you have anything to share in that regard?
I do. I think the setbacks, obviously, the other than the security issue, the primary issue is odor. And I think any of us that participated in Charlene's tours this fall, the hemp growing sites, I just anecdotally again, the sniff test tells me that the odor generated by hemp grow is dramatically less than what's generated by cannabis site. So to me, it's all about the data. There has to be data out there that should drive the setback policy. I know some growers did some research this year, but you know, again, Santa Rosa Junior College, they have a dedicated hemp program. I would be stunned if they didn't have data on terpenes and odor. So to me, it's all about gathering the data, and that data should really drive our policy on setbacks. And that's my view.
Yeah, that's a good input. I would concur with that. Bill Draper, are you? Can you open up your phone line? Do you have anything to add at this point? Ernie, can you tell if Bill's still with us?
He is still with us. I have a feeling he's driving, and
okay.
I know how difficult it is sometimes to play with your phone.
All right. So, we want him to drive safely. So yeah, if he can't comment, that's fine. So I do want to go back to Rod's offer, bringing somebody in who has made measurements, because with David's comment, I agree with the more data we have, the more knowledgeable we all are in terms of what is a fair provision relative to setbacks. So if we could reach out to that individual, Myrna, and invite them to be a guest presenter or something at one of the future meetings, I think that would be helpful. So if Rod can share that information with you, we can extend that invitation. And then with David mentoring, was it Sonoma State you would mention?
Santa Rosa Junior College.
Santa Rosa Junior College, rather. Okay. Santa Rosa Junior College, if there's any one there that David or someone else might know who would have data or would be able to share some information on it, that would be helpful as well, because we might as well reach out to those organizations or research areas where they have actually put studies against it and tried to make measurements, and so we can better understand what are the key differences, if any, and be data driven as opposed to just arbitrary, so to speak. So,
hey, John.
Yes.
Along those lines, I think I mentioned it before, and since we're trying to gather some data, my thinking still is that the more acreage of the farm, the more smell it's going to have. And that was just based on my few tours that I did last year. So, but it makes sense. It actually, in my mind, makes sense. The more you have, the more the smell is going to be. And then maybe the setback might need to be bigger depending on the size of your acreage. So since we're in a data gathering mode is where I was headed with that.
Yeah.
If we could consider that in our data gathering to see if that actually plays out, because size does matter maybe in this case.
Yeah. And I think, from my perspective, the odor drift, I'll call it, mm-hmm. is probably highly affected by wind conditions and everything else. And so,
yep.
You could have a setback in one direction where the prevailing winds come in from and you never sense anything. And on the other side of the field where all of that wind is exiting across, the agro area, you could have it really, really be highly sensitive. So I think there's a lot of different factors here, but we should reach out and see if any of the universities or any of the other experts have measurements of that type. Is it affected by the size of the actual growing area? And my guess is there is a relationship there, but I'm guessing it's probably not linear, but who knows? We need
right.
to
get- Well, and actually, is Phil or Casey on the call? Because when I talked to them, they had said, I want to say 2 years ago, maybe, I could be wrong, but they were actually at a different location, different topography. I think they were actually on the top of a hill, if I remember right. And nobody in the area around them complained about that smell. It was very different being up on a hill. So yeah, the topography is a huge factor, quite honest. And if you're in a bowl, it makes sense that, you know, the people above the bowl, same thing with sound. So there's Phil. He has his hand up.
Yeah, yeah, I just saw him. He's on here. So yeah, let's turn it over to Phil for his comment.
Yeah, so the first year we didn't have any complaints, and it was, we were on Cold Springs Road in the same area that we were. And then when we moved to Thompson Hill, we had some complaints. Some of the neighbors were fine with it and some weren't. And we had the company that Rod's referring to with the nasal ranger come out and do the testing at our field. And with the wind in the direction of the nasal ranger, we were a 7 at the edge of the field, which is considered not a nuisance from the information we got from the company that provided the testing. But if Rod could provide the information and they could join a meeting, I think that would be helpful for everybody. And we did 8.5 acres. I don't know if we were the largest farm or not, but we did roughly 1,300 plants per acre. So we were well over 10,000 plants. So hopefully that'll be helpful for everyone.
Yeah, thank you, Phil.
Thank you. That is helpful.
Hi, John. I'm seeing Chris Perry would like to speak too.
Okay, Chris, go ahead. I wasn't seeing that, but thank you.
That's okay. Real quick, I actually got to jump off and go over the Cemetery Advisory Committee. Of course, there's conflicts today, but I think Danny was smart to just, you know, put in that setback for commercial cannabis just for reference. And of course, I think I agree it should be kind of a data-driven, you know, situational perspective when it comes to setbacks. But I just want to respond to what Rod said as well, because he said 800 feet is not working for the commercial cannabis program because no projects have gone through. Just to be clear, between pre-applications and full submittals, we have already 42 of that. There's about 28 of them that are cultivation related. So when we're talking about setbacks, that would, you know, obviously the setback, the 800 foot setback would have the largest effect on cultivators, of course. And thus far, and that could change, but thus far, based on applications, we're not seeing a deterrent as a percentage of the number of applications that are coming in. So just kind of some food to thought, since Rod had brought it up, it's worth mentioning that, you know, there's the vast majority of our applications at this point in time are for cultivation. So they're gonna have to meet current setbacks in the commercial cannabis ordinance as it's drafted. And again, it's just food for thought to sprinkle on this conversation. I mean, ultimately, the ad hoc committee is going to determine where this all goes. But just so we're making sure we're talking about the facts of what we know so far, just wanted to put that out there. So,
And Daniel advised us early on to try to stay away from the discussion about the commercial cannabis.
Right.
There's some potential conflicts there, so I don't want to let it get too far beyond that. But thank you, Chris, for your comment. And it looks like Jennifer's got her hand up as well.
Thank you, Chris.
Hi, John. I wanted to say, I mean, it's being a neighbor directly affected to the grow that we had next to us. The smell was super strong. Obviously, we had very little setbacks. But I'm just really hoping you guys can figure out something that's going to be, you know, several hundred feet off of our fence line at least, because our house is 1,000 feet away and it smelled really bad every night. The neighbors that live on the other side of the street up high, they still had a really bad problem with smell, and they were probably a couple 1,000 feet away from this. I'm not sure what the best thing is to do for smell, but something needs to be figured out for sure.
Okay, and appreciate that. And maybe this nasal ranger is part of that determination. You make some measurements and you have a better idea of what you're dealing with in a quantified sense, because I know every individual's olfactory, nasal, whatever sense of smell is substantially different, as eyesight and various other things are. Some people are super sensitive with respect to smell and some people are simply not. So there's all those things, which is why it's good to bring in some kind of a measurement device that can give you consistent readings and understandings of where you are with those things. So where you can use the science, but I appreciate your comments, Jennifer, and we definitely will need to consider all those. So, okay. Any other comments or questions relative to the draft ordinance? Murray, are you seeing anybody?
Dale's got his hand up, I think. Is that
okay. Dale?
Yeah, I just wanted to add in that the devices that measure molecules coming in the air don't differentiate. I think we all understand there's terpenes that cause these odors. And the research that I've done into this, that the most objectionable smell has to do with sulfur and the terpene molecule. It makes it smell like a skunk. So I'd like to see some data. If there is in Santa Rosa Community College, they're growing different varietals of hemp, not the CBD flower hemp, but other types. Are they a problem? Because right now the focus is on the CBD biomass, which very much mimics terpene profiles of the, you know, the marijuana plant, if you will. And I think these are minor terpenes that, you know, fall in the thiol category, if you understand what that means. So I like to see some differentiation, because if it does really smell like a pine forest or an orange grove or something like that, I don't know if that would be the same objectionable odor constituent as if it smelled like you're just hit a skunk in your driveway and you're running to take a shower. So just that it's got an odor emanating off it, I don't know, is enough. And it's really complicated to draft an ordinance that deals with all of these different nuances. So I'm curious about the data and see if there's some way to maybe lessen the setbacks if you're not going to grow anything that would be an odor producer, if that's something that we could actually identify. I've seen hemp seeds and plants advertised as low odor. And I never got a chance to really dig in. What does that mean? Because, you know, these terpenes are well known, and, you know, they're in other plants. And I don't think that someone would object if their property smelled orange or citrus, because that's limonene. There's a terpene like that. But if it smelled like a skunk, I think they're going to really upset. And I don't know if all hemp varietals are going to give off those kind of terpene smells. So again, I don't know if we can craft something that will cover all of these. Maybe we have to have some way to differentiate. They apply for some kind of hemp. Maybe there's a way without having to go get a CUP to have a different setback, without having to go in and spend tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars it costs to go get a conditional use permit or, you know, other things like that. Thank you.
Thank you. So it looks like we have Jennifer and Lee both. So let's go with Jennifer. You have another comment?
Yeah, I do, John. Before our neighbors had planted, Leanne had assured us that they were growing a low smelling strain that wouldn't smell at all. And that wasn't true. So I don't know if that's actually what was planted or not, but if it was, it definitely wasn't low smelling.
Okay, thank you for that. Lee.
Yeah, I had typed something in the chat and I didn't know if everybody got to see it. But, you know, as we're talking about setbacks, you know, the county has an established smell level that is acceptable at property lines. And maybe the solution for the setback, because it's a relatively low cost, would be to have a nasal ranger and have the company come out and measure to see if the smell between where the grow is going to be and the neighbor, the closest one, is at that 7 DT level. That is a objective testing measure that could be applied everywhere. And it does away with the burden of the CEQA study and the conditional use permit. So just something to think about as a objective testing methodology for smell.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with you. I think we're trying to keep this simple, and every time you try to do that, you can't. So, but maybe that is a consideration. If the applicant was willing to pay for a survey, maybe that could be done in lieu of standard setbacks or something or other. So I doubt if everybody involved would be, I don't know what the costs are, so I shouldn't even say that. I don't know.
Well, and
if we can use technology to our advantage, we should. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think one comment I want to make here too is that perhaps we're kind of viewing the setback as determined at the point of licensure. If you're determining at point of licensure, a smell test might not be possible because theoretically there's no plants planted yet anyway. You could also determine it as more of just an ongoing requirement on the licensee, as opposed to, but not necessarily a requirement on the licensure process. So it's a slightly different thing on how you, the lens you put towards it. I don't want to, you know, when we talk about smell ranges and stuff like that, we, you know, if we're doing that at the time of licensure, then I start to worry about, are we going more towards a discretionary thing? If you're going to more of those type of calls, one, does the ag commissioner currently have the resources to be able to commit to that? And also, you know, we may be moving more towards a discretionary project, and that would potentially trigger CEQA. That's, of course, a perfectly valid approach for the committee and board to take, but I just want to make sure we're keeping those set of boundary lines aware of as we're going. So.
Yeah, and Chris Pinto actually put that in the chat. I don't know if everybody's able to see the chat very well, but he actually said that you can't do measurements until you have a grow. So That's why I do think it'd be better if we could get established data from somewhere so that they've studied grows and distances and what's happened, you know, that if that data's out there, and I don't know if it is, but it sure would be helpful, because otherwise we're kind of guessing. And you know, smell and smell tests and stuff on things, I don't know. I personally don't trust them a whole lot, because the wind shifts from the day that somebody does a smell test. I know on my property, I've tried to get some help from the county in the past on some smell stuff here. And because the wind shifts and stuff, they weren't able to smell what I did when I did. So I think it's just better to find some existing data where they've studied it, and we put some numbers in and say, here you are. If you meet these numbers, here's your permit. If you don't meet these numbers and you want smaller setbacks, then you're going to have to do the COP. You know, trying to find some balance here to make it work for everybody. But smell is, that's a tough one, you guys.
Okay, and I think Dale had his hand up again, if I wasn't
mistaken. Well, I'm using the same odor guide that everybody else is using, and we're trying to plot drift of odors, and given we're growing a cannabis place that's going to smell, we understand that, and it's going to be different. We can't really come up with a realistic number till there's a grow. We have a chance to get out there and look at the DT7, you know, dilution thresholds, if you will, is that number we're looking for. And no one's going to be able to tell us till we do this, but I would encourage the data be collected and followed within Ag Department so that we can go look at strains that they register to bring in and have some real data of what comes off of that as far as actual molecules, what the DTs are, and what might be causing that. So it might help with future policy. Until you grow something, and you're not going to know, and it would be horrible to tell somebody, oh, we gave you 50-foot setback, but now you smell too much, you got to cut back to 800 feet or something like that. I think that will get you sued. It would be devastating. We shouldn't go down that road. And how to put that in so that we let somebody grow for a year. If you go to your neighbor and say, oh, it's cool with us, do it. And the next year they're going, no, it's not cool. At that point, you can then give them a permit for another year based upon mitigation of something like that. So you don't stick somebody who puts their life savings into this with having to destroy their crop because a neighbor is sensitive to something that they have a right to be sensitive to. But objectively, how do you go in and support that if you get sued, that we pulled the plug because somebody smelled something we couldn't detect with an objective test? And I like to see the objective data. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. So Rod, looks like you got your hand up again.
Yeah, there is data that's been collected, and this person uses air quality modeling, you know, similar to sewage treatment plants or landfills. Cannabis odors are different. They're not as sulfur based. They do environmentally degrade, and there's a different characterization. There's some that smell like bubble gum and some that smell like skunk. That's true. This gentleman can give you some how the modeling's done. So and I got got him from Dale. So we appreciate. He's been working with the planning department. He's submitted his studies to Dave Johnston, Air Quality Control, and the planning department. So they've gone over them. So we'll get him in here if he can come meet with the committee.
So Charlene, let me ask you, have you had any interaction with this gentleman since they've been going through the planning department and other stuff? Are you aware of this?
I was aware that there was somebody that went out to a couple of the hemp grows this year, but no, I haven't had any interaction with them.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. And then Lee, I think you had one final comment or something else to comment.
Yeah. Thank you. Just one last point. And I want everybody to be aware of this. So, you know, growing hemp is a for-profit business. And if we are forced into growing strains that don't smell, that don't sell, then we're throwing our life savings away at something. So I go back to, you know, we need some sort of an objective testing methodology so that we can all figure out what works for where we are and who's near us. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm not seeing any more hands, and I think we're about time to move to the fourth item, which we've already discussed to a certain extent, next steps for the hemp committee. And I think clearly the message that we shared today was, let's go get some additional information, some data if we can, by reaching out and seeing if we can get inputs on the nasal ranger studies that have been done and how they may be able to help us determine parameters that would be associated with either creating setbacks or doing measurements at low cost. You talk about wind effects, et cetera. And then the other one that was mentioned, obviously, was Santa Rosa Community College, to reach out to them and see if they have information that they could share with us relative to some of this. And maybe somebody that could join the ad hoc committee and comment on it, even if that. So David, I don't know if you have contacts there. If you do, I would encourage you to share those with either Myrna or Charlene and see if we can't, pull that thread and see if we can get some engagement there.
I don't, John, but I'll volunteer Charlene to help me out with researching who to reach out to and making that connection.
Okay.
Thank you, Charlene.
So I think that's certainly the thing that we need to talk about next meeting. And then Daniel, any additional, drafting of the ordinance based upon today's discussion, some language that might fit that. That's all tentative at this point, but I think that would be helpful as well. So we can keep things kind of moving in parallel. And when we get to the point of being able to determine, we're ready to either populate the ordinance or we're ready to decide that, maybe a ban is what we need to stick with for a while or whatever the decision may be, that we're able to move in the right direction fairly quickly and not have to start up again, so to speak. No restarts. Let's just try to keep it moving along. So if you're agreeable to that.
Yeah, sure. I'm available to, staff as far as follow up and stuff like that, and we can discuss what we can do. So,
excellent. So, Charlene, any other thoughts you might have on future discussions, things that might be important to bring to the committee?
Other than probably I'll just keep looking into some more information on signage that the counties have been doing and some different items like that.
Okay, that's very good. So anyone else that would like to volunteer something that we're missing for the next discussion that we can add into the agenda? Any ideas at this point? Rod, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to mention that I posted the Santa Rosa program, Dr. George Selu, I think his name is. I put it his contact info in the chat.
All right, very good. Thank you for that. All right. So we got a good lead there. I'm not seeing any additional comments. Lori, anything you think we need to make sure we include in the next agenda?
Nope. Data. We need data.
Data. Yeah. Data. Data-driven. Right. I think that's always helpful, but you can be inundated by data too. So.
Well, right now we don't have any, John. So right. There you go.
Well, we have anecdotal, but that's not very good, right? So, yeah. So we need quantifiable, measurable, whatever, repeatable, all those good terms. So, okay. And so let's talk about then the next meeting. And I'm going to propose we get back together in say 3 weeks. Does that make sense to people? Do you want to go a month? I think 2 weeks is probably too soon to try to work through things with where we are with trying to schedule, but is a three-week bridge here reasonable to most people?
I'm flexible for whatever you need me for. So.
Okay.
Yep.
So, Myrna, can you propose some dates for us? Maybe I'm going to grab my phone here and look at, make sure I don't have any other commitments and some of the dates we might be looking at about 3 weeks out.
So if we were looking at March 7th, or Wednesday's bad, maybe the 18th, March 18th is a Thursday.
You don't want to do it on St. Patty's Day?
No, because you might be wearing all green.
Head start.
Well, if we're talking about green plants, why can't we have some
okay, green? Okay, go ahead. No, we're not doing it for sure on St. Patrick's Day. Okay. No, it's up to you guys.
If Thursday the 18th doesn't work well for me, I've got a number of meetings, including
budget.
Pioneer Energy.
Oh, yeah. Budget.
Budget, a lot of budget. Budget
stuff.
What about 17th? Like, what can we do earlier in the morning? Is that open for you guys?
Yes.
17th in the morning, John? What about you?
Yeah, the 17th, it's a...
I'm trying to see.
10:30? I do have a LAFCO budget meeting from 9 to 10.
What do I have?
Then we have the cooperators call, but I don't need to be on that. So I would be available at 10 o'clock if we wanted to run it from like 10 to 1 or something. I don't know.
10. I have something at 11, but it's not firmed up yet. So I could try to get out of it maybe.
Okay, I'll put you down for 10 o'clock on March 17th a.m. And I'm going to go ahead and try and send out the whole 104-page document to all of you guys that were on this meeting. If it fails, it will be out on our main webpage, but it is some really good information so that the sheriff's had. Thanks.
All right, very good. Thank you. Any final thoughts anybody has? I think we've pretty much concluded today's discussion, and we've got plans for the next one. So,
hey, John, I had a question for maybe some of the growers, or what if anybody is able to find some data outside of looking at the Santa Rosa, because I know you guys have a network and talk to other growers and stuff. Who should they contact with the data? Should they contact Charlene? If somebody finds some before our next meeting, is Charlene, are you the best person to contact probably?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Cause I'm just thinking that, you know, if anybody is looking around and actually finds a good set of data, that'd be great.
I could contact Jim Belushi if you want, see if he wants to weigh in on this. I mean, I love his show on television. It's very entertaining watching.
What? Do you just call him up when you want to?
No, I'm friends with that group of people. Saturday Night Live fan. I can get up.
Anyway. Like, hey, Jim. Okay. You're on. I want to see you do it.
All right. With that good humor, I want to thank everybody for their participation and joining in this afternoon. And we'll get together in about 3 weeks here. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
All right, bye.
Thank you. Bye.